In ancient times, the form of ritual prayer was this, and it gradually became that movement is a graphic, symbolic expression of an integration of consciousness. It's exactly what happened. That movement, if one could have symbolized it in ancient times, this palm, the left palm, would have had an image of a moon, and the right palm would have had an image of the sun. When one brought the sun and the moon together, one had here. One had the thusness of here. In really sophisticated, high-level symbolism, like a Tibetan tanka, you can still see the sun and the moon in the upper portions of the mandala. Any really comprehensive Tibetan tanka will have the sun and the moon up above. So that this position, which has the ritual designation of orants, a worshiper who is in the act of worshiping the divinity out there. That's why the hands are held out like this. Out there. God out there. And the worship is being given out there. And when the hands were brought in and that worship from out there was focused, the worship was in here. This, in a symbolic nutshell, was what happened 2,000 years ago. This was the transformation that led to the appearance of the mysterious person archetype from the divine king who is on his celestial throne to God who is in me now. That movement, that shift, that transformation can be expressed in any number of ways. But the expressions are always an understanding, interpretation of what is really true of me now. Now, the largest form of expression of this was the dome, the architectural dome, and the appearance of religious domed structures as the celestial house of God really are the beginnings of this kind of containment, as it were. Now, the earliest use of a dome structure goes back to what used to be called primitive, but I would prefer to call primordial, house architecture, human shelter. On the most basic level, is generally a domical structure, whether it's the Central Asian yurt or the Plains Indian hogan or the African hut. Everywhere where human beings were able to bring together the sense of shelter beyond that of just a lean-to, it became a domicile kind of a structure. So that later on, the religious cupola, the dome of the synagogue, the dome of the mosque, the dome of the Buddhist vihara, all of these are meant to symbolically and artistically expressed that this is a house of God, with the direct implication that the divinity is of such a nature that he inhabits a house. That he is of such a nature that somewhere he is at home. And that in his home, we are family. Now, all of this was packed into this movement, because the original understanding was that man lived in a dome, man lived in a shelter, in a curved shelter, and God lived in the sky. So one worshipped the entire cosmos, as it were. That was God's house. It was only in historical times that God's house came down from heaven to earth and became a domed structure, which we make. Man must make those domes. If God is to have a house on earth, man must make it. And in particular, the transformation, the alchemical change, was making the dome out of stone, masonry, brick with a covering, but essentially stone. A stone dome can only occur because the mind of man has mastered the idea and has informed his hands to be able to execute that idea in an architectural form. Essentially, the insight here is that stone is formless of its own nature. I'm going to give you a couple of things here. This is from a very famous study done a number of years ago, The Dome, A Study in the History of Ideas by E. Baldwin Smith. It's a follow-up to his study of architectural symbolism in the Roman imperial world. He emphasizes in here, moreover, the dome, like any other curvilinear form, such as the horseshoe arch, could not have originated in cut stone, because rock is shapeless and the image has to exist in the mind of the stone cutter first. Notice how, without the idea in the mind, the form would not exist architecturally. So that the architectural form is a direct manifestation of a mental idea. But a mental idea, no matter how profound, does not do the work. You can have a mental idea very clearly, very forcefully, but that doesn't compel you to go and master the difficult art of cutting stone to make a domed arch. That is a heart energy, which is not in the idea, but is breathed into the idea by some other aspect deeper than the mind. And that other aspect is the deep self, what we call the deep self. It's the deep self that brings the idea and the heart energy together and makes the architectural happening, makes the domical manifestation. And that occurs in historical times. Out of the 150,000 years that Homo sapiens sapiens has been around on this planet, it's only been fairly recently that there have been any stone domes. What does that mean? It means that something is growing, something is evolving, something is happening that didn't happen before. Something radical has happened. The radical thing is that man has learned to bring God in here. Because his consciousness has become aware of his deep self, that it isn't just out there. Yes, it can be out there, but it also can be in here. Art is always of this kind of a nature. It's always a heart energy. Just to have ideas, just to have conceptions, is not art. Just to have ideas and just to have conceptions is indeed a kind of a magic. It's shaping psychic energy to a symbolic mode, but to express it in a media like paint or stone or a life, that is art. That is art. The shaper, the Greek term for that was poiesis, meaning to create. So that creativity is a distinctly integrated human activity that has a divine heart energy in the deep self, which is active. Always, always. Rilke, as usual, has gorgeous lines. This is from poems from the Book of Hours. He wrote this when he was fairly young, not much more than 20 years old. In all these things I cherish as a brother, still it is you I find. Seed-like, you wait, basking serenely in the narrowest compass, and greatly give yourself in what is great. This is the marvel of the play of forces, that they so serve the things wherethrough they flow, growing in roots to dwindle in the tree trunks, and in the crowns like resurrections show. Gorgeous. Even in English translation. This quality of becoming conscious not only of what we do and the meaning of what we are doing and the integration of it symbolically into a sense that this has some kind of a central purpose, all of this is not conscious in art. It is done in art, but is not conscious in art. The consciousness of that, the consciousness of what this art has done, that belongs to history. That's what history is. History is that further story that one is able to read out of the art of what one has done. And history is a very, very recent phenomenon. In fact, in India, there are no histories. Some places, there are no histories. In Africa, there are no histories. Herodotus, who was the father of history, lived 2,400 years ago. That's not very long ago. He's the first one to conceive of the idea of history. And it was a Pythagorean insight that got him going on that. Pythagoras said, geometry is history. Geometria as historia. That insight of Pythagoras started off Herodotus, and from then history developed. It's quite different from an epic. If you look at, for instance, the book of Genesis in the Old Testament, it is a classic epic. It's not a history. It's an epic. What is it the epic of? It's the epic of the renewal of the covenant generation by generation. How did this generation do it? How did that generation do it? What was involved and so forth? It's a sequence, but it's a sequence that revolves around an unknown center. The center is a mystery. Who knows? God only knows. Why all this? We know that we have done this. We know that this has happened and that this is a sequence, but why? That's a mystery. But in history, the center is known. In history, the center is known because we ourselves are there at the center. For someone who is capable of a history, they are conscious of themselves at the center. All of this is meaningful to me, not in an egotistical sense, but in that sense that finally the divine is in me. And the sequence and purpose of all of this is to elucidate for me that contact, that presence. And so history has this kind of a consciousness. Now we're going to be moving into history. We're going to be trying to understand for ourselves our history. But it's very difficult to do. The consciousness of history, the historical aspect of consciousness, is very difficult to bring into focus. It's a hard thing to do. It's not easy. One can miss it very, very, very easily. The most likely happening, the probability is very high that instead of understanding history, you will simply fortify a mythology. Instead of coming to a historical understanding, one will come to an elaborate, subtle, mythic conception. And this must be avoided. In all of the high Dharma teaching techniques, this is really one of the most difficult of all of the transformations to make. And so generally, in the wisdom traditions, East and West, at this particular point, the emphasis is always on the fact that you essentially are selfless. Why is that? Is that an agnostic or an atheistic or some kind of negative ploy? It's a way of taking out of play the mythologizing tendency of the psyche. The psyche cannot help but mythologize because that's its essential feeling nature. That's what's appropriate to it in terms of feeling. It does that all by itself. You don't have to have it taught to you, and you don't have to have it highly developed. That's just how the psychic is. The psychic energy tends to have the images link up into stories. If you just let yourself go, as you do in dreaming, any image that comes up begins to form a story. The dream continues. And you can have any image. It doesn't matter what image it is. The only thing that stops that process is introducing into that level of consciousness an imageless image. And making an imageless image is a very high act of symbolization. The imageless image is a symbol. Notice that if you remained on the level of image, the imageless image is a nonsense designation. The imageless image negates whatever an image is, but it's a peculiar symbol. Now, the best usage of this, the best way to talk about this that's ever been devised by human beings was done in late India, about 1000 AD in our terms. The kind of term that came out that talked about this was that when one sees in the field of imageless image, one has the ability to see in clear light. Now, this is a very poignant quality. Light is always colored. Light is color. And if one refines through tremendous purifying capacity, one can see that all of the colors of light come down to a white light, the most primordial, that is the undertone base that carries light as a phenomenon in the first place, is a white light. So that clear light does not ever exist in nature, qua nature. Clear light is a supernatural level. Instead of a phenomenon, clear light is a noumenon. Instead of phenomenal with properties and qualities, it's noumenal with no properties, with no qualities. So that if one talks about the numinous quality of clear light, one talks about generally what it is not. The famous phrase, neti, neti. It's not this, it's not that. It's not this, it's not that. It is this. It's not any kind of a polarity where distinctiveness yields qualities, but it is the integration where there are qualitylessnesses everywhere. Now the great Indian sage who brought this into refinement was named Atisha, or sometimes the proper pronunciation in Tibetan would be Atisa. But Atisha, I'm used to using that pronunciation, so I'll continue. Atisha, at a very mature age, lived at a time when civilization was crumbling in India, and he took himself into Tibet. And so this particular technique survived in Tibet alone. It died out in India. And the Tibetan culture, its main Vajrayana Yogacaran tradition is based on Atisha's whole presentation of this. And I'll go into this if I can a little bit later. I have it all outlined here for you, and if we can get to it today, why we'll do it. I should give you three stanzas from Atisha. His whole poem was around the idea that he himself is a lamp to light the path. The whole notion of a path comes from Atisha. There's no sense of a path is a symbolic designation and manifestation. All of our usage today, all of the occult usage of a path and so forth, comes from Atisha. That conception was not there before. The lamp on the path is the man himself. That is to say, his divine center, which resonating with clear light, that's the lamp. And without being able to see in that numinous realm, one does not understand what is being said to one. There's an intermediate step between not understanding what is said. There's an intermediate step of understanding what is said, but still doing nothing about it. And then there's a third step of not only understanding, but actually doing it. And so, this wonderful translation of it was published in England, 1983. A Lamp for the Path, and there's a commentary by the Dalai Lama. In that there are inferior or mediocre or superior persons should be understood as three. The characteristics of each are very clear, and I shall note how they differ from one another. One who by every means he finds seeks but pleasure of samsara and cares but for himself alone, that one is known as the inferior person. One who puts life's pleasures behind and turns himself from deeds of sin, yet cares only about his own peace, that person should be called mediocre. One who wholly seeks a complete end to the entire suffering of others because their suffering belongs to his own conscious stream, that person is superior. In other words, it's a very sophisticated presentation of selflessness. One is selfless, but there is a network of interpenetration of beings, and that pattern is real. One negates one's own ego, not to pull some kind of cute intellectual trick, but actually one's commitment is to the reality of the interlocking pattern of all beings. My suffering in isolation is unreal. But the travail of all sentient beings together, that is important. That is important. Why is that important? Why is that real? Because all sentient beings have this inner presence, whether they know it or not. And that inner presence is but one in all. So that the linking pattern of all is real. But in terms of oneself, one would say one is selfless. You cannot say, I am selfless, but that the activity that you do is of such a nature that it expresses your understanding of that, your appreciation of that, the depth of your quality of that. Now in the Western tradition, where this was developed first, Asia gets this from the West. In the Western tradition, where this was developed first, the symbolic way of talking was not in terms of sight, but in terms of hearing. In other words, the primordial religious sense in the West being a visual kind of a quality is underlaid by an aural quality. And in the West, the most direct path to the deep self is through sound. So that silence became the way of talking about it. And I'll give you just a couple of lines since I gave you Atisha, who was about the best there is in the Asian tradition, about the best there is in the Western tradition, is this some lines from Saint Ephrem, a Syrian religious genius of the 300s. The seed swollen with moisture bursts asunder its covering of soil and out peers the blade of wheat full of symbols. So faith, whose bosom is filled with goodly fruits, is a blade-bearing praise. Fish are both conceived and born in the sea. If they dive deep, they escape those who would catch them. In luminous silence within the mind, let prayer recollect itself so as not to stray. petition that has been refined is the virgin of the inner chamber. If she passes the door of the mouth, she is like one astray. Truth is her bridal chamber, love her crown, stillness and silence are the trusty eunuchs at her door. She is betrothed to the king's son. Let her not come wantonly out, but let faith, who is publicly the bride, be escorted in the streets and the back of the voice, carried from the mouth to the bridal chamber of the ear. For it is written that there were many who believed in our Lord, but out of fear their voices dishonored faith. Although their hearts confessed, yet he considered those who kept silence along with those who denied. Jonah prayed a prayer that had no sound. The herald was put to silence in the fish's belly, and out of the dumb creature did his prayer creep forth, and God on high heard, for his silence served as a cry. In a single body are both prayer and faith to be found, one hidden, the other revealed. The one for the hidden one, the other to be seen. Hidden prayer is for the hidden ear of God, while faith is for the visible ear of humanity. Now there's not an ounce of difference between St. Ephrem and Atitia in understanding man's true position in this universe. There's no difference whatsoever. They could have sat down with some interpreters and in 2 hours looked eye to eye. What's important for us is to understand that our activity as artists, our activity as human beings, is a deep resonance. It's like a pulse from the deep self. That the deep self, that symbolic integration, does not integrate in some particular place. It doesn't come together at some particular point at which one can stick a part of the compass and then draw the circle and say, that's me. Instead of a point, there's a focus. That the deep self, instead of being something, is a focus of all things. But that focus is so powerful that around the focus generates a tremendous energeia. And of its own nature, that energeia, when focused powerfully, responds by a pulse out. And that pulse out, in its rhythm, makes all this real. Makes me real. Makes us real. So that the resonance of the pulse of the deep self is like that radiation. That's the clear light. That's the silence. Well, you can see that with that consciousness, the person is a permeable movement rather than something. So that any aspect, a photograph, a role, a period in your life, is but a mask compared to this. Any conception that one has, any notion of identity that one has, no matter how refined, no matter how supported, is still, compared to this, inner focus and its pulse, but a mask. Now, a world that insists that you have your identity, and you believe that you have your identity, and that it's worth fighting for, it's worth killing for, you can see the depth of ignorance. You can see it's not only ignorance, but the extraneous, unnecessary complications. One of the things about Dharma is that it evaporates karma. One thing about truth is that falsehood no longer exists. The classic statement, and it's absolutely true, is that there is no possibility in heaven of seeing hell. That's what makes it heavenly. But when you're in hell, you can always see what's in heaven, and that's what makes it hell. It's a colloquial way of phrasing that. In a very deep samadhi, there is absolutely no trace of the complications of this world. There's no residue. There's nothing left over. There's nothing to deal with. And the classic development in Vajrayana was done by Tsongkhapa, and that tradition in Tibetan designation is Lam Rim, and it literally means that the stages grow until at the last stage you see that there are no stages. The keeping of the stages in the meantime is important because it's like a scaffolding that you're building this dome of your interior self. But when you do build that, the scaffolding is of no importance whatsoever. The fact that there were stages is inconsequential in retrospection. So that in imagination there are steps, but in memory there are no steps. The memnonic quality of truth is that it is seamless. But the imaginative projection of truthfulness is that it's very hard to do and gets harder and harder and harder. So that there is this there's this odd kind of a quality. One of the most difficult of all things, then, is to shift from a sense of what all of this means for yourself as a person, and understanding that your person is mysterious indeed. Your identity, however you conceive it, is just a mask compared to the real person that you are. Probably the most poignant expression in the visual arts of this is an etching that Rembrandt made. He made it in the early 1650s in Amsterdam, and he was in a period of his life where he was... I guess you must understand and appreciate Rembrandt was a real genius. He's a first-class genius. I mean, there's all the difference in the world between somebody who is just very good at something and somebody who is a first-class, world-class genius like Rembrandt. And he was tussling with the idea of what is man's relationship to God. And at that time in Amsterdam, there were people and ideas coming from all over the world. Amsterdam in the 1650s, 1660s was like Los Angeles is now. There was a bit of everything in the world there. There were Jesuit scholars who had translated the I Ching into Latin and brought it to Amsterdam, and they weren't sure what they had. The Amsterdam of Rembrandt had Spinoza living there, and had the young Leibniz circulating around. It was a fantastic place. Comenius was there. It was an unbelievable place. And out of the tussle, to try and understand, Rembrandt had a flash of genius, and he made this print, and I've Xeroxed or copied off for you this print. It's the most mysterious print in art history. And there are copies there on the table if you care to have them. And you can look at that print. And on the printed page that went with it in this book, it's not a very good or adequate commentary, but you can see. Number 28 is the description for this print. We look at it, and the first designation is Faust. But we notice here that in 1679, this print was called The Alchemist. The Alchemist. Well, now, you don't see any alchemical equipment. There are no flasks. That is a... Go ahead and have one. If somebody doesn't have one, please step up to the table and help yourself. The reason for this misdesignation, The Alchemist, in 1679, it was not possible for most people to differentiate, because of a mythological comportment, alchemy from the process that Rembrandt is expressing here. That's because in the earlier 17th century, alchemy had been shown to be an external mask for an internal process. The internal process has traditionally been referred to as a Christian yoga. That what made alchemy work was not the equipment in the laboratory, but the presence of God in the alchemist himself who made the transformation. And it was not possible for most people in the 1670s to make that distinction. In fact, it wasn't possible for almost 300 years after that. It wasn't possible until our own time, because the mythological story was so powerful that it co-opted the differentiable capacity of consciousness. Very, very different. For instance, somebody on the order of Sir Isaac Newton was never able to make the differentiation between alchemy and Christian yoga. He spent the last 30 years of his life trying to puzzle out what the tie was between the book of Ezekiel, the book of Daniel, and the book of Revelation. He knew that there was a tie. He was brilliant enough to see that those three formed a whole pattern. In fact, they were the three, they were the trifoil, which was the base of the true dome of understanding. That was the archaic architectural symbolism that was cinched into place in Roman imperial times. Where does the dome go? The dome goes on a threefold base. It's only when you get to a genius like Giotto that he was able to see that the dome doesn't go on a threefold base, the dome goes on a square. And it took a couple hundred years for someone, finally Bramante, to figure out how to do that, how to put a dome on a square. Giotto could see that was its true nature. But how to do that, that was beyond him. Sometimes you're just outstripped by situations. The important thing in this print by Rembrandt, if you look at the print itself, set aside all of the descriptions here,